Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. I made a New Year's resolution to learn more about early childhood education, since it's one of Tulsa's great community strengths. But in spite of state-funded universal pre-kindergarten, statistics show that almost half of our children are exposed to trauma of some sort. Trauma here is not defined as we might think of exclusively as violence or abuse, though that's certainly a small and horrible percentage of this. Most of the trauma comes in the form of neglect, or children bearing witness to parental conflict. With our increasing understanding of the prevalence of this problem, the medical and social work fields have developed better approaches to treatment of trauma by getting kids, even as young as preschool, into supportive play and therapeutic environments that can put them back on normal courses of development. My guest today, Dr. Sarah Coffey, is a child psychiatrist and practitioner of such trauma-informed therapy. She holds the Oxley Endowed Chair in Child Psychiatry Research at the OUTU School of Community Medicine and has recently co-founded the Oklahoma Academy of Integrated Care to help broaden understanding of this type of work. Dr. Sarah Coffey is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Sarah Coffey, welcome to Medical Monday. Let's start by just asking you to define what trauma-informed therapy is. And you treat kids, you're a child psychiatrist. So what does it mean specifically and then for children?
That's a great question. So I'm a child psychiatrist, and I primarily see kiddos anywhere from age 3 to 18. And trauma-informed therapy really focuses on trauma as the source of issues with behavior. It's looking through the lens of trauma to understand how to provide some education for parents, as well as caregivers, that perhaps if a kiddo's had a significant traumatic event or has been really scared or frightened, that they might react in a certain way. So we provide some education to parents about what that looks like. We help kids to regulate their emotions and to help them feel better. We help them to understand that the trauma isn't their fault and to find a way to not make it so emotionally toxic for them.
Is this a relatively new field?
Not necessarily. I think it's getting a lot more traction because of the recent ACEs study and adverse childhood events, but certainly from a very early stage of understanding psychology and development, we've been understanding how the environment plays a role in how we feel and what we do.
Do you have any sense, I mean, you work in the field, so you must have some parameter of how many children are afflicted with trauma?
Yes. More recently, actually, John Hopkins did a study, and they note that about 50% of children have had an adverse childhood event in their lifetime.
Half of children?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Wow.
Well, and I think it's important to know, too, an adverse childhood event doesn't necessarily mean a traumatic injury or physical abuse, but could be issues regarding emotional abuse or neglect or a family member who's been incarcerated or perhaps living with a family member with a real significant mental illness or substance abuse. All of these adverse childhood events can really play a role in a child's behavior and their emotional well-being.
On that list, too, if I'm not mistaken, is parental conflict. So divorce, for example, or separation can be one of the things that's scored as an adverse childhood event that can obviously, we know this from life, but also from
yes.
films and all kinds of novels that children of divorce or parental conflict wind up having issues, for
yes,
sure.
Yes, this is true.
One of the places that you see patients in the community is up at the Wayman Tisdale Specialty Health mm-hmm. Center in North Tulsa, and you are... I guess, how do kids get referred to you there? Do they just sort of come in, or their parents know about you and bring in their kids, or are they referred to you from schools or from their primary care doctors?
So really from all aspects, I often see kiddos referrals from a primary care doctor because they're having behavior concerns in school. Quite frankly, we often see school-age kids because that's when they're starting to have trouble, and so the teachers might notice it. They tell the parents to go to the doctor. The doctor looks in to try to find treatment for them, and they get referred to us to help with their behavioral and social issues.
In terms of the patients you provide care for, how many times are you able to suggest or make a behavioral intervention alone, and then how many times would it require medication? I guess what I'm asking is, I know from adults mm-hmm. that therapy plus medication tends to work better than either therapy or medication alone. And I guess I'm inexperienced with children, I guess other than my own. But in terms of medically caring for them, psychologically, psychiatrically, how prevalent is the need for medication to sort of help control behavior or impulses?
That's a great question. And I think, because oftentimes when we're thinking about trauma, we're thinking about a diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder. So a kiddo's had a traumatic event and then they develop PTSD. But what we often find is that kiddos that have had trauma, only about 30% of them will go on to have PTSD, but about 70% of them will have functional impairment. And so they're struggling in school, they're not turning in their work, they're having difficulty concentrating. And so it makes it a little bit challenging as medical providers to treat because they don't necessarily have a diagnosis that has a lot of research behind it. If a kiddo does have PTSD or has difficulty with functionality, oftentimes behavior is the first intervention. Actually, if they have a diagnosis of PTSD, trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy is really the treatment of choice.
There's only one of you, although at the OUTU School of Community Medicine, we now have, is it five child psychiatrists?
Yes, we have five child psychiatrists.
And you have a fellowship program, so you're actually training the next generation of child psychiatrists for Tulsa and Oklahoma, which is a wonderful thing because there is a woeful shortage of people in your field. Mm-hmm. You told me once before about one of your patients, who we won't name, obviously, but who has a father who's incarcerated and sees no hope and has, I think, bounced from school to school and been labeled a problem child, literally a problem child, everywhere he goes. And how were you able to intervene in that case? I mean, that, in some ways, I mean, it's very sad, but it sounds somewhat typical. I mean, typical for a problem child, that is, with behavioral issues who gets expelled, I guess, and, mm-hmm. and from one school and another. And then pretty soon the record for that kid is going to follow him or her around and make it virtually impossible, certainly for him to stay in school, graduate mm-hmm. high school, go on to higher education. I mean, so in a sense, repeating the cycle of struggle.
Absolutely. I mean, I think first and foremost, as a physician, the first thing we do is to make sure that the immediate safety is there. So kiddos often come to us and they might have difficulty because there's abuse in the home. And so it's making sure that their home is stable and that they're safe. So that's what we do. The second thing is to certainly, you know, educate them and to find ways to kind of work with the school. We know that teachers are doing a really good job. They have so many kiddos that they're trying to take care of, but often just kind of helping the teacher to understand the social issues that the kiddo is going through can be helpful to help them establish a relationship. And a lot of the trauma literature, one of the main focuses in kind of a trauma-informed therapy is attachment. And so it's making sure that a kiddo has a trusting relationship with a parent or a caregiver, a teacher or an adult. So really helping to foster that can be one of the first lines that we do to help the kiddo succeed.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Sarah Coffey. She holds the Oxley Endowed Chair in Child Psychiatry Research at the OUTU School of Community Medicine. She practices as a psychiatrist and does research and advocacy and a lot of teaching, actually, around trauma-informed therapy for children. And Sarah, one of the things I think you get involved in is individual education plans. This is when mm-hmm. kids need some kind of specialized, tailored education. You know, they can't just go to school and do the regular thing for mm-hmm. multiple issues, right? So there might be cognitive issues. There might be behavioral issues, psychiatric issues. How does that work? Because I know that if you're not involved in it, it seems fairly complicated.
Yeah, it is very complicated. And I think that I often tell my fellows that I train that if you've been to one school, you've been to one school because they all kind of handle it in different ways. And I think it's important for us all to be communicating with the schools and the specific schools that the child is going to. Quite often what happens are there's universal measures to help children succeed, both academically and social and emotionally. So they might do like a morning meeting. They might do something. They have some rules and regulations, which can be really containing and good for kids. And the majority of kids will do well with this kind of structure. That's tier one. Tier two are kiddos that are struggling in the classroom. Maybe they're struggling academically. Maybe they're just struggling behaviorally. And oftentimes the school has modifications or a behavior plan to put into place to kind of see if the kid can get some response with it. So let's say a kid has a lot of anxiety and gets really stressed with a lot of people in the classroom when he's getting ready to take a test. Perhaps the school will let them take the test in a quiet area. They might have a little bit more time to take the test. So they provide some modifications to help. And then if it seems like that level isn't working and they're still struggling behaviorally or still struggling academically, we'll get to tier three. And so they'll get more of an individualized education plan. They'll often do testing. Quite often a school psychologist will do testing to look at how they're achieving academically. They can also do testing to see if they have ADHD or anxiety, depression, or other emotional issues. And then a treatment plan will be developed to help tailor the kids' needs.
Wow. I mean, it's multifaceted.
For sure.
Involves a number of different professionals. And it sounds like to use a buzzword, multimodality therapies are involved, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I think quite often, so you have a school counselor, you have a school psychologist, perhaps an occupational therapist, a speech therapist, really all taking a look at a child individually to see where their deficits are and where their strengths are. One thing I think it's important to note, too, is that this is a process. So kiddos, they might see how they're doing. Teachers are equipped with classroom management techniques to try to help them in the class. But if they're not able to do well after so many weeks, they'll make another modification. But like most things, we have to give it some time to see if it's going to be helpful. But oftentimes as a parent or even a practitioner or a teacher, you can really feel like you want something to be done very quickly to help a child succeed because the school year can get away with us so quickly.
You know, a couple of months ago on the program, we had Alan Schwartz who wrote a really good new book, sort of an expose called ADHD Nation. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And I just wanted to go a little bit further on that. Is that the thesis of his book was essentially that we have come to overdiagnose that. I mean, it may not be a surprise to you or maybe to our listeners, especially if you heard the program, but that it's sort of an all too convenient label to give to kids for whom another diagnosis, perhaps depression or anxiety, might be more manifest and giving them stimulants may not be the right thing to do. But it's because public schools, if I understand correctly, are required by law to accommodate students with certain types of learning disabilities, the schools will typically push, and I don't mean any specific school here in Oklahoma or in Tulsa, he was talking more generally as a trend nationwide and, of course, gave specific examples, but that there is kind of a push from the schools themselves to put kids on medication. Is that something you see or would you be the recipient of that kind of pressure if it existed around here?
I think first and foremost, it's important to know that really out of all of the treatments and diagnoses that we see in psychiatry for kids, whether that be ADHD, anxiety, or depression, that really ADHD has the most robust study to show that medication works. So if there is a kiddo that does have a diagnosis of ADHD, studies actually show that medication is just as good as medication and therapy combined. So there is a push for medication with that. However, the other piece of that is that kiddos that are misdiagnosed as ADHD, and I think that's a really valuable discussion to have because quite often we see kiddos that have a lot of chaos in the home and this kind of developmental trauma or complex trauma. They have difficulties with attention and focus, so they can look very much like ADHD, but in fact they don't meet full criteria for it, and there might be other factors that are contributing to why they're struggling academically. And certainly we can see misdiagnoses and going down like a medication trail where they're not quite getting better.
So just give us as an example, and I know there's no one average patient because everyone is different and unique, but how long might someone be under your care? I mean, and obviously it's going to depend on how ill they are or mm-hmm. how difficult a time they're having, but I mean, can you give us a ballpark of how many like actual sessions or appointments it might take to get someone on the road? And then do you start to space them out as things might improve?
Quite frequently, we see children in the office and we'll see them for an initial evaluation anywhere from probably about 2 hours. And we're talking with the child. Yes.
Wow.
I know. I saw a look by Dr. Yes. Schumann there. So, yes, I think that's the nice thing, and certainly in our department, that we have the ability to really understand the needs of children and their patients. We're doing an interview with parents, with the kids. We're often talking to therapists as well as the school to really develop an accurate diagnosis. Quite often the evaluation takes several visits to really understand what's going on. And then if we're making medication adjustments every couple of weeks to every 4 weeks until things get more stable, and then quite often seeing patients every 3 months or so, we love to have the combined effort with pediatricians and help to support them to kind of take over care. For ADHD, oftentimes it's thought to be more of a chronic disease, and about 2/3 of kids will go on to need to continue to take medication. With our other illnesses, such as anxiety and depression, quite often medications are meant to treat the symptoms for 6 months to a year. And after children have been symptom-free for that long, coming off of the medications and making sure that symptoms don't return.
I'll ask one more about ADHD and then go away from there, but this might be a loaded question, but it occurs to me that it definitely falls within your area of expertise, but I imagine that because of the numbers of kids being labeled by schools or parents or being worried about a behaviorally troubled kid, is there sort of a turf battle between the general pediatricians and, say, child psychiatrists about giving the right diagnosis, being able to make the right diagnosis, or is it just that it is so prevalent, even with overdiagnosing it, so I should say in the reality, if we exclude overdiagnosing, that it's so prevalent anyway, that it's, you know, a general pediatrician could definitely handle it? Or do you find that oftentimes a general pediatrician will say, you know what, this is not a day-to-day stuff, so let's get the consultation, that two-hour evaluation, and beyond that, that's going to really help us tease out what is at stake here?
Mm-hmm. I think it really depends on the individual pediatrician. And I think that certainly in Oklahoma, we have so many rural areas where pediatricians are really going above and beyond to diagnose and treat because there's not access to child psychiatry. So that's issue number one. But also just kind of the limitations that primary care docs and pediatricians face. I have the luxury of being able to spend more time with patients and to do more therapeutic interventions. And when I look at my pediatrician and family practitioner colleagues, like having 15 minutes to kind of see and really get into the nitty-gritty of things, time is of the essence. And to be able to be consulted and see a child psychiatrist to really take the time and have the time even to make an accurate diagnosis, I think is important. And I think for us to be able to work together is really the most beneficial thing that we can do as providers.
I want to go back to trauma-informed therapy. How specifically would trauma-informed therapy differ from, say, just therapy? Like, in other words, you would have to know, I guess, specifically that a child or a patient was a victim of some kind of trauma in order to invoke trauma-informed therapy. So, I mean, in what ways is it different? I mean, because I think of therapy mm-hmm. as being consultative and helpful and comforting, soothing, et cetera, but also making a diagnosis. Is that, I mean, maybe it's not a fair question.
No, it is a good question. And I think probably the best way to answer this is education that the therapist has about trauma and how trauma affects behaviors. And quite often just about how the child looks with that. So if you can imagine a child who has had significant violence in the home that gets really dysregulated, that then goes to the therapist and the therapist is working with the family and saying, oh, this is a behavior that the child needs to be SWAT for or hit for. And I've heard that. To me, that's not trauma-informed because we know from the literature that certainly more positive reinforcement and positive parenting is going to be most helpful for our kids to develop behaviors. But also if you have a real traumatized kid who's had a history of violence in the home and then you're using a physical punishment to mold behavior, that can be problematic and it can make the child behavior worse, quite frankly, and kind of can lead to more dysregulation than positive outcomes.
Okay, just about a year ago now, you wrote a really interesting op-ed piece in the Tulsa World where you were essentially saying that you'd like to see the public schools have invoke mental health therapy in the schools and have more of a trauma-informed approach. Take us back. What were you advocating for?
I think I was advocating for a greater understanding of the foundation of social and emotional development in kids before academic capacity. Certainly the end goal is for our children to be successful and maintaining their goals academically, to be learning. But quite frankly, I think we don't understand that social and emotional development comes first. And without an ability to regulate, with ability to feel safe, they really struggle to learn. And we need to really put a heightened focus on that social and emotional development to lay the foundation so they are able to learn.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Dr. Sarah Coffey. She holds the Oxley Endowed Chair in Child Psychiatry Research at the OUTU School of Community Medicine. She also is an advocate, a teacher, researcher, and practitioner of trauma-informed therapy. And last February wrote an op-ed piece in the Tulsa World. It was titled, Mental Health Issues Need to Be Part of School Discipline Consideration. And you are doing some work in local public schools. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I've really started doing a lot of professional development on trauma-informed care. The Massachusetts Children Advocates and the Trauma and Learning Policy Initiative has done a lot of work looking about how trauma affects academic success. What we know is that kiddos that have experienced adverse childhood events are more likely to fail a grade, have problems with their expressive and receptive language, more likely to be in special education. And so a lot of this professional development is just to educate teachers and administrators that, look, this is happening, and how can we make a difference in our kiddos who have had a lot of adverse childhood events and trauma?
So what did I understand you're working with Union Public Schools?
Yes, I am. And I feel very privileged and fortunate to be working with Union Public Schools. We actually have a school-based clinic at Rosa Parks Elementary School. And under the lovely guidance of their principal, Karen Vance, we have the opportunity to provide really direct consultation to the teachers. We're actually providing some educational services on oppositionality, anger, ADHD, and really trying to foster that understanding and community about how social and emotional issues really play a role, not only in children, but also in our adult lives as well.
So that's pretty neat. So you're not only in the school literally and providing therapy service there, but really training the trainers, teaching the teachers.
Yes.
Right?
And giving more. And for sure. And I actually think a shout out to our channelists and psychiatry fellows who are doing this project with me. It's been so informative for us as well to be able to sit with these amazing groups of teachers and learn about the experiences that they're having in their classroom, the connections that they're making with their students, the work and the effort they're putting in with their students, and then to turn to my fellows and say, okay, now they're doing this kind of work on top of trying to teach a curriculum. I think it's really helpful for us as providers to understand what our teachers are up against.
What would you like to see in the future? So in your op-ed piece, you were essentially saying, hey, we need to scale this, for lack of a better word. You want to put this in more schools. So, you know, obviously is what we should say, funding is going to be an issue. Are there ways in which we could scale the work you are able to do and your colleagues and your fellows? I mean, how can we replicate this and make it more available to more schools?
Absolutely. I mean, I think really first and foremost, to be able to kind of use that as part of the teacher education curriculum, just even in undergraduate classes, I think that even our special education teachers have kind of a minimal understanding of the social and emotional needs of kids, and they're probably the teachers that are most likely to have that kind of education. But if we can start there, I think that's a start. But also being able to kind of incorporate social and emotional development as part of professional development with our teachers would be really helpful too. And certainly providers like myself, and there's others in the community that are here to be able to offer it. But the hard thing is that we have so many federal mandates and kind of issues that our teachers have to do already. The challenge is feeling like that's not one more thing that has to be done on their monumental tasks of things that they're already having to do.
How did you become interested in child psychiatry yourself?
Well, so I like to thank my mother, who's a social worker, for that. So I grew up with a social worker mother who really taught me about the importance of families and being an advocate for children. I actually worked in the Department of Human Services for 2 years prior to medical school as a case aide in child welfare.
Wow. I mean, that's impressive because, I mean, you just don't see a lot of medical school applicants who've done that kind of work. I mean, you do see some, but I mean, specifically working for DHS. I mean, so you saw firsthand what some of the human service needs.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I was in permanency planning. And so really my job as a case aide was to transport kids back and forth across the state for family visits or sibling visits or from hospitals. And what that allowed me to do is really just spend tons of time talking with kids as we drove everywhere.
That sounds like hard work.
It was really hard, but it was also, I think it really kind of provides the lens of how I treat families and patients as well. I think that the majority of kids that I was working with, regardless of what was happening in their home, they wanted to be back home. They wanted to be with their mom and their dad. As a, you know, a 20-year-old, you know, person with not even a pet or probably a houseplant that I was taking care of, I often wondered how I was going to be perceived by parents. And what I found was that the parents really cared about their kids, that they were struggling with their own substance abuse or mental illness or a lot of multi-generational trauma. But it didn't, you know, discount the fact that they loved their children, that they were trying their hardest. And I think to be able to support families and to kind of to do that kind of work is really important and valuable in our society as a whole.
So you mentioned your mom, but so what? Then what led you? It was that work at DHS, and you just said, "Aha! I want to do this. I want to be on the doctor side of things."
I think so. I mean, so I was fortunate because I actually did some research at the Child Study Center, I worked with them, and so I had the chance to talk with Dr. Bonner, who was a child psychologist, and she very helpfully introduced me to a developmental pediatrician, a child psychiatrist, and other docs as I was deciding what kind of physician I wanted to be. And there was really something about child psychiatry that I felt was going to give me the most education and tools in my tool belt to help people. I've always been fascinated by the brain and behaviors, and it's a wonderful work to be able to learn from that side of things, but also the art of healing. And that's really what drove me to become a child psychiatrist, and it's a privilege every day to work with the families and patients I get to work with.
So you grew up in Oklahoma and went to school here, but then wound up going outside of Oklahoma for residency and fellowships. How were we lucky enough to get you back? Was it written in the cards you knew you were coming back to Oklahoma because the need is so great here?
I think the need was a huge thing. I think also family was important too. So I could certainly say that my family would be a strong indicator for that. But the need is huge. And I think I did my training at Cambridge Health Alliance in Massachusetts, where that's probably the most condensed area of child psychiatrists. But even there, there's still a need. And certainly the families that I worked with as a case aide are forever resting in my heart. And I'm always thinking about the kiddos in the foster care system. So to be able to come back here and make a difference is something that I'm really honored to do, and it's something I'm really passionate about as well.
How long is a child psychiatry fellowship?
2 years.
Okay, so this, I just want to tell our listeners that you go to college and get a bachelor's degree, so depending on, you know, where you go, that's 4 years typically, or it could be three if you're accelerated, and then 4 years of medical school.
Yes.
And then 4 years of a psychiatry residency, and then 2 years on top of that.
Yes.
So you can see the pipeline is very long to create a credentialed child psychiatrist. So given that the numbers, probably the need well exceeds our capacity to, in spite of the incredible work you and your colleagues are doing at the OUT School of Community Medicine and training child psychiatrists, what are some things we could do to, again, go back to this question of scale, whether it's telemedicine, where you do consultations for folks in rural areas or places where there aren't any child psychiatrists, or training term of art, mid-level providers, physician assistants or nurse practitioners. What are some ways you've experienced or would like to see, I guess?
Yeah, so I think that's a great question. And the, I guess the thought is that there's never going to be enough child and adolescent psychiatrists to meet the need. But there are a lot of innovative ways that we can kind of extend our services. As a fellow, I had the opportunity to work with Dr. Catherine Grimes, who's a child psychiatrist, and Dr. Greg Hagen, who's a pediatrician, on what we're calling kind of a behavioral health clinician integrated model in Cambridge. So myself and my attending were located in a pediatric office, and we would provide direct consultation and kind of guide the pediatrician on some recommendations on what to do with patients. And if the patient was struggling or really needing a psychiatric evaluation, we would refer them for a psychiatric care. But in the meantime, the pediatrician could manage the patient, could make recommendations for medication. We could triage patients and kind of get them to the appropriate level of care. In psychiatry, in the adult world, there's a lot of great models like the collaborative care model and other integrated models that really allow patients to be treated in the family practice or pediatric office with some additional support from child and adolescent psychiatrists or adult psychiatrists.
So that integrative model then, if I understood correctly, is just that you are, in a sense, were embedded in the primary care clinic to provide that consultation right on the spot.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so that way it's scalable in the sense that you're not seeing each individual patient, but you're getting a maybe dozens of queries even a day or something.
Yes.
So it's almost like doubling your capacity in a sense.
Yes.
And is that something that we're seeing in Oklahoma?
No.
Oh.
So I think, I think we need to. And I'm excited because we just started the Oklahoma Academy of Integrated Care through a generous grant from the Telegen Foundation. I'm now serving as the executive director of the Oklahoma Academy of Integrated Care. And we have a conference coming up here in February. And the hope is to train physicians and providers about what this integrated care looks like. Certainly, we see a lot of this outside of Oklahoma, and I think the hope is that we want to do more integrated care practices, but we're not really training our physicians and our residents that are coming up on what these models look like. So it's still a little new here.
So you're actually, in a sense, you're bringing the integrative experience you were a part of before to Oklahoma. You're bringing it here.
Yes.
And starting your own organization, essentially.
Yes.
Well, that is great.
Essentially.
Well, Sarah Coffey, it's been a pleasure talking to you. It flew by. You are the Oxley Endowed Chair in Child Psychiatry Research at the OUTU School of Community Medicine. Sarah Coffey, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
For more information about the Oklahoma Academy of Integrative Care, you can email oaic@ouhsc.edu. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.